You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
Broadcasting across the state of Wisconsin on the Civic Media Radio Network and around the world on the Civic Media app, this is the Dom Salvia Show. And now, here's your host, Dom Salvia.
And thank you for listening to the Dom Salvia Show. Happy, happy Friday to us all. It is beautiful here in Waukesha, Wisconsin, driving in today. 82 degrees and sunny, had the roof back, the wind blowing through my hair, man. It is amazing. We got an amazing show set up for you today. James Santel, former U.S. Attorney, host of Amicus, a Law Review, that broadcast out here on the Civic Media Radio Network on Saturdays, 9 to 11. Jim, welcome back, man.
Dom, great to be with you again on this beautiful day in the state of Wisconsin and in the United States of America.
It is awesome. Thanks for joining me. Aaron, working hard on the board. You can join us as well, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. Later on, Brian Karam, columnist at Salon, and former White House correspondent with Playboy magazine. He's going to join me at 5:30. We're going to talk about some Trump fatigue. And I'm feeling some of that. And maybe a little source of voter suppression in a weird kind of way. But we'll get to know Brian Karam in the 5 o'clock hour. But Jim, missed you last week, man. I know I only got you for an hour today, so I certainly appreciate the time, man, and love catching up. Some of the things that I saw that I wanted to pick your brain about, the judge is going to, again, this is Judge Chutkan, right, allowing the release of redacted evidence in Trump's federal election case. Now, we already saw the release of, what do I got, about 160 pages of evidence that was, now this was released by Chutkan, right?
Absolutely. So what happens here, of course, is that Jack Smith, who's a special counsel, he says, here's my entire thing, Judge. It's all this writing.
And here's my homework.
Here's my homework. I'm submitting this, and it was homework. And he says, this is what I'm going to do. I'm going to try the case. This is why the Supreme Court's immunity decision does not prevent you from going ahead, set this case for trial. And he also provides her, of course, with a redacted version of this. And he says, there's text. Here's all this writing that I put together. My colleagues put this all together. And then there are also some exhibits that are attached to this. And all this is going to convince you, Judge Chutkan, that all you need to do is go ahead and schedule this on for trial. So that's what he submitted with redactions and to her as well for consideration. She's seen the entire thing, of course, as has defense counsel. She previously, as we discussed, she previously released that narrative portion, basically what the trial is going to say. But she held back on the evidence pieces. Maybe it's their reports of interview. Could be some grand jury testimony. We're not quite sure.
So the narrative is created based on the underlying evidentiary documents, which we have not yet seen.
Exactly, right. And we've got a lot of quotes, of course, as you and I talked. We've got a lot of quotes in that narrative about what, again, everybody from Steve Bannon to Mike Pence said. Mike Pence trying desperately to convince his boss, the president, that he should simply stand down now and run again in 2024. Other people around Donald Trump saying to him, no, Mr. President, you have lost. You have lost. And again, the response is coming back from them, from him, saying, well, I basically, yes, I know, doesn't matter. We're going ahead anyway. All that is establishing his intent. That's what we've seen already. Now we're going to get some additional materials. And she does say, again, submitted initially in a redacted version. She says, you know what? What Jack Smith has presented to me makes sense, and I'm going to release those materials. Needless to say, Donald Trump and his counsel are maybe not melting down, but the legal version of that are saying, no, don't do any of this, especially not right now, right before the election. Again, Tanya Chutkan, good for her, the most beleaguered judge in the United States of America, been given this horrific assignment by the Supreme Court. She says, you know what? Donald John Trump is a defendant in my courtroom. I recognize that. I will treat him as I will treat everybody else in my courtroom. He happens to be running for the presidency of the United States of America, but that's not going to dictate my decision-making. She has basically said, we will see the additional materials that that Jack Smith has appended to this document. Also note for those people who think this is somehow unfair, She is also giving Donald Trump the opportunity to respond to all of this.
7 days.
Right. Actually, she's giving him until after the election, right?
Oh, okay.
And, right. So he's, again, they asked for more time. They asked for a page limit expansion, too, which is exactly what they gave. She gave to Jack Smith as well. So she's given them an opportunity, and there'll be a reply opportunity. So this is normal process. This is what we do in pretrial motions. And presumably sometime, yes, that's right, sounds wild, but in 2025, maybe in early 2025, she will look at all this and say, this is what we're doing when it comes to the trial. Maybe even set a trial date, and then we hold on to see if there are more what are called interlocutory appeals. Are you taking that up to the Court of Appeals? Maybe back to the Supreme Court again? Oh, my goodness. Hold on for 2025.
NBC News reporting from yesterday that the judge approved the release of redacted evidence that support the brief unsealed this month in the case, but allowed the former president 7 days to attempt to block the disclosure.
Yes, yeah.
Okay, that was the 7 days in my head. So even as it stands right now, she's going to release this apparently, but Trump has 7 days. To right. What? To kind of get his ducks in a row and see if he's going to appeal this? Or what was that? What does
right.
that mean?
Basically, she has announced what she wants to do. And she has said, before I press the button here and release this to the clerk of court's office, Donald Trump and counsel, I'll give you another chance. Boy, talk about bending over backwards. Going to give him every opportunity, setting up a nice appellate record here. I'll give you another opportunity. If you think I'm completely wrong, tell me that now. Tell me that right now. File that brief with me. I'll take a look at that in the next 7 days. She will certainly consider it. She'll think about it. My guess is she will still release his materials. And then she will also, so that was the other deadline I was thinking about, which is post-election, she will give them an opportunity to respond formally. This is about whether or not these materials themselves should be released. She is, again, giving them every opportunity to be heard
on the
release itself.
And I get that. I'd hate to see deferential treatment, you know, to the nth degree, but, you know, this is a former president.
Absolutely.
This is a big deal. This is a... also a convicted felon. So it is feasible, given the timelines that we are aware of right now, Jim, that this underlying evidence could be released prior to the election.
Absolutely. Again, the 7 days, let's count. We'll do some math here, right, on the airwaves and figure that out, assuming that maybe it takes her a day or so after she's digested that to issue an order. It doesn't have to be a long order. All she needs to do is say, I find in the interest of justice that indeed these materials should be released. These are public proceedings. That's the other piece of this. This is not grand jury stuff going on. This is all going to be a part of the public record in any event. And so, again, part of my initial response, even to Jack Smith saying, I'm presenting this to you, all of it's under seal, was, well, you know, why are you even doing that, right? In normal cases, if you and I were defendants, all these things would be filed in the public domain. To your very excellent point, Dom, she is saying, I'm going to give you every opportunity to tell me if I'm wrong, explain to me why I should go in the opposite direction. Maybe you'll convince me that I shouldn't do this. Probably, right? but probably not. She's already released the guts of this.
Yeah.
And there may or may not be something really compelling in those additional materials. There probably will be a few items. But again, we'll just underscore this notion that there is a triable case here.
Yeah.
And maybe some of those documents are the kinds of things you mark as exhibits, and those will be presented to the jury in the course of the trial that she would schedule.
James Santel, former U.S. attorney, host of Amicus, a Law Review here on Saturdays on the Civic Media Radio Network, 9 to 11 a.m. Check it out. Jim, one of my concerns about this, I have redaction fatigue. You
yes,
know,
right.
After the Mueller report,
seen that,
man,
right?
You know, all the toner.
All the toner that
we
expended, pages and pages of black print, right?
Is it possible that we would actually get something that would be as redacted as Mueller? I mean, that we couldn't basically use. Or do you think there? I mean, what's your opinion?
My sense of this is that, again, Jack Smith knows that eventually this is going to be in the public domain. And because of that, even though it's premature, this is not the title trial, but it is the trial anticipation here, right? My guess is there's not going to be pages and pages of things blacked out. He has already given to her a version that apparently does have some redactions, we think. And she's looked at that and she says, yeah, this sounds reasonable. So she is not going to release a thing, whether it's 25 pages or 30 pages, that just dissipates your entire toner a tank in all of our printers here. There is going to be something there to see.
There'll be some meat on the bone.
Exactly, yeah. Right. And maybe, again, something that supports some of these anecdotes that we saw in the narrative piece, right? Various people, again, as I said, coming to the president in those days right before the election, those three lunches that Mike Pence has with the president, which he's trying desperately to talk him off the ledge and, again, doing all these other things, all of that. There may be some additional information about the context of that. There could even be, again, speculating wildly here,
certainly.
Right?
That's
right?
What we're doing.
Man, that's what we do on radio,
we're
right?
We're on the radio, man. Right? We got to speculate.
We know that Jack Smith has gotten some of the electronic evidence here. We know about the president's use
of Twitter,
right?
Yeah.
And so it may well be that some of those are recorded and printed in old-fashioned way so that we can see those. There may be other records, maybe some other White House records that show where he was at various times. Who was he having conversations with? For the most part, maybe not on the Trump of White House, but those kinds of things, the president's activities on a daily, minute-by-minute basis, those are recorded. And again, on January 6th, as we well know.
Yeah, but are they? Are they, though, Jim? I mean, weren't a bunch of calls that came into the White House, like the log went missing kind of a thing?
Well, that's the concern, right? And if Jack Smith has gotten those logs, and I'm not saying these are Nixon recordings in the sense that we were going to get the tapes themselves, but recordings of, okay, who came to see the president on January 5th? Who was in the White House, in the Oval Office, in the dining room adjacent to that, in the Roosevelt Room on January 6th at 4 o'clock in the afternoon.
Great question, Jim.
All those kinds of things.
Yes.
Jack Smith may well have records of that because those kinds of things have typically, in most administrations, been accounted for historical purposes and also for executive branch purposes as well. He may have a lot of that. Why is that important? Because once again, establishes who was in touch with him. We've got all those unindicted co-conspirators, right, in that indictment. Many of those people may have been in touch with the president in that time period.
Jim, given the environment of MAGA right now, kind of on edge, you know, seemingly dark, violent rhetoric, let's just say.
Yes.
Some of the folks that have given quotes and testified before the grand jury and for Jack Smith, is it possible that the quotes would be in there, but they'd redact the person's name?
That is possible, too. All kinds of things could happen here. As we know, when we read through the narrative on the memorandum itself, identifying from the indictment, also the narrative, we can figure out pretty well.
Right. Person one, person two. Yeah,
all these people, the attorney general, who's the chief of staff, we know, Rudy Giuliani, all these folks, we know who they are by virtue of the context clues about their conversation. But all kinds of things could happen there. And again, I would offer just this, that for the most part, grand jury testimony protected by Rule 6E, produced to the defendant before the trial, generally not released unless it is by the imprimatur, the authorization by the court. So my question, again, is whether or not some of the things we've seen already, including some statements by the vice president, we know he testified in front of the grand jury, are those from that testimony? Did he give another report to the FBI at some point prior to even that appearance?
Lots of information to come out yet. I can't wait to see it. Can't wait.
Exciting time in America.
Can't wait for the trial. Folks, this is the Dom Salvia Show. That is James Santel. Our number is 855-752-4842. On the other side, going to come back. Sentencing 3 weeks after election. Is it possible Trump gets jail time? Welcome back to the Dom Salvia Show, 855-752-4842. It's Fridays, and when Friday comes around, James Santel joins me in the studio. If you get your little fix of Jim today, you want more of a rush, you can check him out tomorrow, Saturdays 9 to 11 on the Civic Media Radio Network. Appreciate you making time for me today, Jim.
Great to be with you, Dom, as always.
As mentioned, the sentencing for his hush money trial, the 34 counts, felonious counts.
Right. A jury finding him guilty, just to make this clear, felonious counts, 24 of them, beyond a reasonable doubt, unanimous verdict. He is a convicted felon.
Jury of his peers.
Exactly. In New York City, right?
Trump is peerless if you just ask him.
Absolutely.
Guilty. Sentencing's 3 weeks, literally 3 weeks after the election. How was that? The 26th, right? Tuesday, November 26th. And the question, does he get jail time? And I saw this article a few days ago at the New York Times.
Yes.
And they did a review of dozens of cases, and what they found was that approximately more than a third of the convictions resulted in defendants spending time behind bars.
It's very compelling. And again, all this is public record, right? These are all misdemeanors or felonies, all those kinds of things. You can go to the courthouse and you can do this. So the New York Times,
you
can do your own research. It's not just the New York Times, Dom. I know you're going to be heading off to the court, clerk of court's offices on a regular basis, doing this sort of thing for the future broadcasts of this fine show as well. And you're exactly right. So, you know, initially when he was convicted, there were an awful lot of people pontificating and saying, well, he's not going to go to jail, that sort of thing. There are two things that come out of this reporting and two things we've always known, which is one, just statistically, yeah, maybe not the great majority, but the majority of people who've been convicted, again, this is a Class C felony. He does face up to 4 years in prison. He will not get that. We need to be very clear on that, although he could. But the reality is an awful lot, a slight majority of the people did get jail or prison time, right? The other alternatives, of course, are probation with no jail time or some other penalties, fines, other things like that. And then you got that statistical base out there, right? This is what has happened. Similar crimes, maybe similar offenses, similar defendants, maybe not. And that's where you move to Donald Trump. And that's where you move to Juan Merchan as well. And we know as well that there's some additional overlay to this, right?
Yeah.
Which is that Donald Trump spent most of the trial not just criticizing, but just viciously attacking Juan Merchan and, of course, his daughter and members of the jury, members of the court staff, all kinds of people, also violating Juan Merchan's so-called gag order. Nobody was gagged here, but the appropriate order saying that, you know, do not interrupt the normal course of the rule of law here, the normal course of justice, violated that repeatedly. The judge sanctioned him for that. All of that can also be taken into account by Judge Juan Merchan over and above the offense conduct itself. There is absolutely nothing wrong with the judge saying, you know what, I think that in this particular case, in a normal circumstance, I would impose this penalty upon you. I find that your behavior aggravates that. And for that reason, I'm going to increase it in some dimension as well. He can do that. There's nothing unlawful about that. I realize that there's some portions of our population that respond outrageously to that. That happens all the time.
All the time.
All the time. And the judges can also consider, believe it or not, uncharged conduct in that pre-sentence report that he's got already prepared by the New York probation officer, whoever that is, who had the assignment of sitting down with Donald Trump and saying, let's talk about your offense conduct.
Who wants that crappy job?
Right. And talk about needing more money, right, for your position.
Yeah, right.
All of that report that he's got in front of him reports not only upon this, it would go back and explain his financial situation. Bankruptcies of the past. We'd talk about the E. Jean Carroll case, the financial fraud case that's now up in appeal. All those kinds of things are there. Why? Because you want to have a judge who knows as much as possible about this person who's standing in front of you. It also would include, to the extent there are things out there, the so-called mitigating things, right? If there are things about his health, about his family, about his life, his upbringing, all those kinds of things, his history would be set forth. The idea behind a sentencing is, again, this is not a jury deciding whether you're guilty or innocent. You want to have a jurist who's looking at this particular defendant, looking at the offense conduct, and making justice happen.
Right.
And it's got to be based upon not only the offense conduct, but who is this person sitting in front of me, standing in front of me? What is their life story that brings them to this point? And I can consider virtually everything. Now, the judge is probably going to say in his remarks, which he can do, I'm sentencing you principally for your offense conduct here, but he can in fact comment about all these other things, including, as I said, especially this misconduct, even during the course of the trial itself.
Jim, what about other misconduct? When this first came out, the sentencing was going to be pushed back till after the election. I was like, oh man, that's some bull, right? But now I'm thinking, Donald Trump will never bend his ways, right? He'll never bend to the court. That won't happen. I don't think it's going to change his behavior in any way. But if Donald Trump reacts, say, similarly to a loss in this election like he lost in 2020, and he reacts the same way in 2024, would that behavior, those actions, be held against him by the judge in this other case? It's got nothing to do
with
what happens between now and the sentencing date.
Right. Again, those kinds of things, probably not the principal focus of what Judge Merchan will do here. But if between November 5th and November 26th, that 3-week period of time, There is conduct that is in the public domain. You don't need to prove any of that beyond a reasonable doubt, but it's in the public domain.
Right,
if you are inciting another riot in America, right?
You know, and maybe he's if he's more angst about it, right? When he stands up, yes, we're going to rebel. Well, I mean, it doesn't have to be just come, we'll be wild. If he goes, says they will be wild, or you know, it's time for a revolution in this country. Those kinds of it may not be necessarily illegal to express your First Amendment rights, but. Yeah, it sounds like you're kind of trying to, you know, rile things up a little bit. Right. Would that be something that the judge could take into consideration?
Certainly can, yes. And I say that with a small c because, again, the judge doesn't want to sentence him for that conduct specifically, but also wants to send the message. We've talked a lot on this broadcast about deterrence, right? Wants to stop this particular individual. One of the other things he will say at the time of the sentencing is, by the way, Mr. Defendant, you are obliged to follow all the rules and regulations, all the laws of the state of Wisconsin. If you haven't done that recently, I can also take note of that, even though it's not the principal reason for my sentencing you as I'm doing that today.
Folks, this is the Dom Salvia Show. That is James Santel. He's a former U.S. attorney. He's the host of his own fine program here on the Civic Media Radio Network, airing on Saturdays from 9 to 11 a.m. If you can't make that, make sure you check out the Civic Media app. You can download and listen to all the live programs and get the podcast as well. Come back. We'll take some of your calls. 855-752-4842. It's a phone line. It's a text line. 855-75-CIVIC.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
Dom Salvia Show, 855-752-4842, 855-75-CIVIC. James Santel, former U.S. attorney, host of Amicus, a law review here on the Civic Media Network, Saturdays 9 to 11 a.m. for another half hour. Looking forward to it, Jim.
As am I.
So we spent a lot of time on the one case. This is, I think, of course, the most important, well, maybe not the most important case. The J6 case will actually be the most important
case. It's the federal case, right? It's the one that goes right to the core of what he did. And I think that's the reason why it is appropriate to call it maybe not the most important in the cosmic sense of the world, but frankly, it's the one I think that focuses on the really true crime that Donald Trump committed, which is trying to overthrow the government, right?
Yeah, it's problematic.
It's problematic. It is concerning, right? These other things are also crimes, not to dismiss them, but they probably fall at a slightly lower tier in terms of the overall public consideration of how we think about Donald Trump these days.
Okay, so the other crimes, let's talk about. Jack Smith involved in two of the cases, of course, one being the J6 insurrection chucking case, which we talked about. The other one, of course, being the Florida, quote-unquote, documents case, the hoarding of the crown jewels, the United States secrets in his Mar-a-Lago for well over a year, almost 2 years, and lying about whether or not he had them and giving them back and playing games, traveling with them.
Some of them end up in New Jersey, apparently, when we're presenting documents, maybe about the invasion of Iran to people who are writing memoirs.
Or hell, man, he apparently had lots of conversations, if you believe the reporting, with Putin, but we're not going to go there right now. That case, the Trump-appointed federal judge, Ellen Cannon, she eventually got around to dismissing the entire case.
Dismissing on a threshold ground that she could have done if she wanted to do this a long, long time ago. She's got other motions no longer pending because she made very clear, I am done with this. What she does, again, in the fairly near past here, she says, I am buying into what Clarence Thomas had suggested. In his own Supreme Court writing that maybe, just maybe, in her case, she believes, yes, not just maybe, that the prosecutor here, Jack Smith, improperly appointed, no constitutional authority, that only the president could do this, the attorney general does not have the authority, contrary to not only precedent out there, Supreme Court precedent, contrary to everything else that's happened in recent years, she dismisses the case saying, Jack Smith, You have no authority to do this. Jack Smith says, thank you very much. I'm taking this up to the Court of Appeals, which is the court, the federal court, once again, above the court there in Fort Pierce, which is southern Florida there. And they now have that in front of them, entertaining oral argument. They've got briefs coming in as well. Highly likely, again, the prediction of a plan here in 2024 often goes awry, but difficult to imagine that even the 11th Circuit is going to say, yes, Eileen Cannon, you're right. Jack Smith has no capacity to do this.
And if that were to be the case, then every single special prosecutor that has ever been appointed ever in the history of special prosecutors would have been unconstitutional.
Absolutely,
right?
Including those that have investigated and prosecuted Republicans,
right,
and Democrats across the board, right? And if that does happen, then Jack Smith and the Attorney General will certainly authorize then an appeal to the Supreme Court. You've got to take that up. Let's assume that that will not happen, that the world is not quite that crazy yet. And for that reason, the Court of Appeals then sends us back and says, no, no, you're wrong, as they've done before, at least twice before
now,
in this case.
Couldn't
right?
Trump and his legal team then take this to the Supreme Court? I'm sorry. I mean,
they could. But again, at some point, then the Supreme Court's also got to say, yes, this is a case we want to weigh in on. Now, they've said that in the past plenty, right, three times, yeah, right? Colorado, remember that? We've got that Fisher case, not really Donald Trump, but close. And, of course, the big immunity case. They sat on that for a while. They could take this on. Boy, I sure would like to think that our Supreme Court, with some vestige of integrity yet, would still say, we're not addressing this issue. So again, I'm hoping that they would not grant certiorari on that issue.
On that.
It goes back, presumably, to either Eileen Cannon
or
fascinating to see if either they direct it or if Jack Smith requests, after it gets remanded, which is the fancy word for sending it back to the trial court, does he request a different judge? And he says, look at the laundry list of things that she has done to show bias in this matter, including, by the way, getting involved in the investigation itself a year,
right,
and a half ago, right?
Right.
All of that.
Bias,
right?
or incompetence? I mean,
right,
what,
right,
would that also be one of the
and absolutely
marks against her?
And you probably don't even have to describe what the motive for this is. She's, yeah, done an awful lot of things to try to derail this case. And for that reason, judges, assign this to somebody new. And, yep, maybe make that petition to the Court of Appeals. Maybe it goes to the chief judge of the district court. It's entirely possible. It'll be fascinating to see, and we will talk about this on your broadcast here, who is going to be handling this again, probably in 2025 when it comes back. And then, of course, all of the motions that were pending when she got rid of this case, those are all resurrected again.
Well,
and
they are.
We go back again because you're reinstating the case once again to the way it was before. And so all these things that are both in the public domain, they're all in the public domain, but in our public discourse and not, including once again the immunity issue. That's also being presented there, right?
Any sense of timing on that appeal? Like, when do you think that'll come down?
They should be pretty much done again with pleadings and oral arguments by the end of this year. And so, depending upon how busy the 11th Circuit is, you'd like to think they've been pretty good in responding to these things in the past. Probably sometime, I would say, in the early months, maybe weeks of 2025, okay, but let's give it months, maybe by March or so of next year. And so, again, that will be either right in the middle of the second Trump presidency, which will be fascinating to see, or it will be the middle or the start of the first Harris presidency. Different consequences, plainly, depending upon who the American population elects to the presidency in just about a few days here.
James Santel, former U.S. attorney. Let's talk about the status on the Georgia case.
Yes.
The sign me 11,780 votes case, the RICO case,
right, right,
the sweeping RICO case.
Many defendants, right?
And
right,
lots of action. They try to get Fani Willis kicked off the case, and they got rid of her lover, former lover prosecutor, and all that. But where are we standing on this one?
Sure.
Tim?
So what happens there, of course, is that Scott McAfee makes a decision. He says Donald
Trump. Judge.
That, right, exactly. He is the presiding judge. Again, the state court judge. So kind of analogous to Juan Merchan in the New York court. Different case, different allegations, but they're both state court judges, unlike the federal cases. And so what he says is, you know, I'm looking at this entire thing, analyzing exactly what you just described, Don, and he says, you know what, I find that there's sort of an appearance of impropriety here, having your romantic interest at your counsel table with you, but I do not find that this is so offensive that I need to throw you off the case. And so for that reason, he says, I will either keep you on the case if you get rid of co-counsel here, or there may be some other consequences here. He leaves again that very same day, and she goes on then to prosecute the case after that. That's the decision that Donald Trump has now appealed again to the Georgia appellate court, saying, no, no, Scott McAfee was wrong. He should have thrown her off the case, finding that this is a conflict of interest. Where that is, I don't know. I don't think Scott McAfee knows either. But that's Donald Trump's position. The appeals court now, again, same kind of thing. Appellate memorandums, appellate arguments going on. They will at some point resolve that issue. Like to think once again that they will similarly abide by what Scott McAfee has done. You then take that up to the Georgia Supreme Court, right? And so that's another option there inside the state of Georgia. And yes, indeed, here's the specter out there. The Constitution of the United States of America says you can also seek review by the United States Supreme Court if you're coming out of the highest court of a state. Okay, and that's why some of the Wisconsin cases involving voting.
Let's assume for a minute the appeals court goes along with Judge McAfee's decision, allows Willis to stay on the case. Trump's team will appeal that to the Georgia Supreme Court.
Yes,
that'll be another several 6 months, maybe.
Easily.
Right? And then if that comes down against Donald Trump, then he will, presumably, why wouldn't he? I mean, you got all your all your donors giving you money for your legal fees. Kick that up or at least ask for the Supreme Court.
At least try. Seek what's called the writ of certiorari there. Again, I like to think the Supreme Court will have other more important things to be taken care of, but you never know. You never know. Depending on time and place here. But yes, that's the process here. It is going to be a long time there as well before Scott McAfee schedules this on. Remember as well, we've got some defendants here, including some attorneys and at least a non-attorney who have already pled guilty, right? And so that is no small thing. But again, many of them have not. That is the major RICO case, as you and I have discussed in the past. That case remains pretty much inviolate. The judge got rid of six counts. They do not undermine dramatically the force of that indictment, but that is still there. Again, depending upon what the appellate court does, there is still the option of a trial being scheduled for some time in 2025, depending upon all of these alternative timelines with the appeals courts and with what Donald Trump may or may not do in the future.
The civil case, the Tish James case, this was, you know, Trump falsifying his records for maximum profitability, you know, insurance versus taxes, all those kinds of things, playing games, basically, you know, constituting a long-running fraud against the state of New York, found guilty, right?
Right
off the bat, the judge kind of said, it sounds like guilt. And then what? Fine, like $500 million
exactly,
or something.
Right.
A lot of money. That also being appealed. And my impression was, those hearing the case were kind of like, wow, that seems like a little high.
Exactly.
What was your takeaway?
Yep, absolutely. The same take precisely. So it goes up to the appeal of the appellate court there in New York. And again, this comes from the oral argument. It's not their final decision at all, but the judges always send signals, right? Yeah. They listen, Mr. Santel, I'm doubtful of your position, right? They would say that to me all the time when I'm in front of the Seventh Circuit and part of my routine practice in the past. And so you've got the appeals court judges there looking at the attorney general's representative and saying, isn't this sort of high, right, in terms of a number? Also looking at whether or not some of the laws actually apply. Did you get the right statute here? Basically quizzing Tish James and her colleagues on the merits of what the lower court judge, his name again, Arthur Engoron, remember his name? He's also, again, a trial court judge there in Manhattan. He's the one who enters the order. He enters a very compelling, it's lengthy, it is exacting. It is very specific. This is not somebody who wrote this overnight. So it's, there's a lot to chew on there. Whether the appellate court was simply, I don't want to say playing with the attorney general, but wanted to test the validity of this case coming
up. But as well they should, right?
I mean, absolutely.
And you're in an appeals court. I mean, that's what you're supposed to do.
Absolutely. And when I stand in front of any appellate court, the reason they ask me those tough questions is they want to know what the response is.
Yeah.
And if I don't give a good answer, and it appears that, gee, in fact, this is extraordinary, or there is something wrong with the statutory basis for charging a case, that pretty much confirms that maybe we got to do something to remedy what happened. It could be that. Most often when judges are expressing some concern and you get that feel from the oral argument, there is probably something there. Not to say that they're going to overturn the civil judgment
entirely. Yeah, I was going to say, let's assume there it's overreach. But he is guilty, but maybe not half a billion dollars guilty. Can they just reduce the amount? What's their option?
All kinds of things.
Okay.
You know, if they find indeed that the trial itself was somehow flawed in some major way, evidence introduced, they could order it back for a new trial. Unlikely that will happen. That would be the most extreme remedy, probably. Yeah. They could, you know, maybe the most extreme would be dismissing the case outright if they find some misconduct. There is not here, so that's not going to happen. But they do have the option, again, once again, to send it back to Judge Engeron and say, redo some of these calculations. We find that this particular finding by you based upon these records is overstated. We think this is problematic. Depends upon where they find problems. And right. And if they find those, they could send it back for a new judgment to be entered.
And no matter what happens, could this still be appealed then to the New York State Supreme Court?
They could still. It's right. It goes up and down, goes back and forth. And absolutely all those things are still out there for appellate review. That's our system, and that's the way it should be, even though I know it sounds frustrating to many listeners out there.
Well, when you have hundreds of millions of dollars of your donors' money, it certainly helps to seek justice slash delay.
Right. And, you know, we were talking before about Mershon, and, you know, one of the issues here is that, you know, Donald Trump is now being sentenced after the election. Well, you know, Donald Trump also made the decision, again, to appeal to pursue all these things in front of Judge Mershon. He still hasn't resolved the issue of immunity there. He's got that inside this. And even the Tanya Chutkan case, the reason why we're still dealing with that now is because of the appeal, again, ultimately to the Supreme Court.
Folks, this is the Dom Salvia Show. That is James Santel, former U.S. attorney and friend of ours. It's Friday, so we're getting caught up on all the legalese. There is some ruling, a Supreme Court ruling on a Texas abortion case. Also, some of our texters want to chime in here as well. This referendum here in the state of Wisconsin on the ballot, changing the word from every citizen to only citizen. What does that mean specifically? I want to get your take on that. Plus, we'll get some of our phone calls in. 855-752-4842. Dom Salvia Show. Happy Friday to us all. James Santel, last segment with the former U.S. Attorney, host of Amicus, a Law Review, here on Saturdays on the Civic Media Radio Network, 9 to 11 a.m. We have some callers. Let's get to them, and we'll get to a couple other specific questions I had for you, Jim. Let's start with Scott from Whitewater. Welcome, Scott. What do you got for us?
Yeah, I'm not trying to be outrageous, but with the new ruling for Trump, could Biden say, listen, Trump is a threat. I'm going to go to my chief of staff and have the military eliminate Trump. And on the same token, could he do that with the Supreme Court? Could Trump get into office and say, listen, we're going to get rid of this amendment saying presidents can only be in two terms. You're going to change that to as many terms as I want. And if you don't do that, you're a threat to democracy. And you might be next on the chopping block.
I mean, thank you for the call, Scott. I mean, there's very serious, scary,
absolutely
circumstances right, that could come right. out of this immunity. The whole order of the SEAL Team Six. I mean, some of the justices literally brought this up to Scott's point. What would happen?
Right, and so Scott, you're taking a page from Sonia Sotomayor's vigorous dissent, saying virtually she says immune, all these kinds of things. You are establishing a super presidency, and not just for the particular facts of this case, but for the future as well. And again, we've got a president right now. His name is Joseph Biden, who, of course, is not going to do those things because he's a decent man. He understands the rule of law. He understands how American history and justice works. He's not going to do it. But there's a concern about a future presidency. Yeah. And that's the concern that's out there. That's why, Scott, to your good point, cannot overstate it. It's not hyperbolic. The United States Supreme Court changed the Constitution on July 1 and changed the geography of this nation. Unless at some point there is a movement away from that opinion, we've got the law right now, which is not consistent with what James Madison and our founding fathers put in place 238 years ago.
Thank you, Scott. 855-752-4842. Mark from the SAC, you're up. Welcome, Mark. Happy Friday. What do you got for us?
Yeah, Yeah, well, to echo what Scott said, I mean, under the Constitution, that the Supreme Court doesn't have the power to do this kind of thing. That was one of the concerns of both the presidency and the judiciary, that they would assume this kind of thing like they had under the monarchy. So it's just absolutely ridiculous that they've done this. I guess the original point I called in on is, could we not see all the names of all the unindicted co-conspirators that were involved in the, let's say, the fake electors plot? Because I'd like to know the names of all those people. And that should be released before the election. And if, you know, it's Scotty Fitzgerald and Tommy Tiffany and the other, you know, traitors to the Constitution that participated in the fake electors conspiracy, because my position is, if you were aware of that, if you were that even tangentially heard that something was going on like that, and you did not denounce that immediately, you violated your oath to uphold the Constitution of the United States and have no business being in office. I've, you know, challenged, you know, my current state senator, who's running for state senate here on the Republican side, to condemn the fake electors thing. And, you know, I've heard, you know, that I've heard boo. I mean,
I'm not surprised, Mark, but you might not know this. And I found this on the notus.org, N-O-T-U-S.org, one of my new sources here. Jose Pagliari and others writing, of the 82 slated Republican electors in Arizona, Georgia, Michigan, New Mexico, Nevada, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, 14 people who took part in Trump's scheme to overturn the election are listed among the Republicans' representatives in the Electoral College in this election cycle.
Isn't that something?
So, right? 14 of the 82 are right back at it again.
And again, we talk about deterrence, right? This is Mark's point as well. Unless you say to people, I'm going to stop you individually, that's specific deterrence. You got to stop you. That's the reason why, with the exception of the state of Wisconsin here, virtually all the other electors have been individually charged with their crimes for making false statements, misrepresentation, again, attempt to undermine things. And also you want to send the general deterrent message, you try this again in 2024, you're going to get in trouble. And that's the concern, where they're back again. That deterrent impact is not out there unless you've done the prosecution and actually, once again, gotten the convictions. And yes, some people spending some time behind bars.
Carol from Madison, we'll squeeze you in here. Carol, welcome. What do you got for us?
Hi. I'd like to ask your guest about Marbury versus Madison.
Yes.
Whether he thinks that's correct.
Is Marbury versus Madison correct? Okay, so again, this goes back to the early part of the 19th century. This is when we've got fights, if you will, between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams about the delivery of a commission at the time. Has to do with what the ultimately the Supreme Court says in that case. Again, invoked recently. This is why you're calling, Carol. In this case, you've got a statement by the Chief Justice in that case saying it is decidedly the purview and province of the judiciary to say what the law is. Now, we've understood that ever since that time to say, all right, you interpret what statutes mean and whether things are constitutional or not. The problem with the Chief Justice invoking that language from 1803, I believe it was, is that what you've got going on here is a change in the Constitution, right? That's different from interpreting the law and telling us what it should be.
Yeah.
And yet John Roberts looks to that and says, see, 200 years ago, I'm not doing anything different. I'm not doing everything different from what I was told 200 years ago. That Chief Justice then said this. I'm simply restating it here.
Thank you, Carol. We're running out of time. We're not going to have time. Jim, thank you so much for spending time today. I want next time
Absolutely.
We talk, we'll talk about this Wisconsin constitutional referendum,
yes,
changing the words every citizen to only citizens. I want to get your take, but we're running out of time. Thank you so much, folks.
Dom, always a pleasure to be here.
Tune in to Amicus, a law review hosted by James Santel, Saturdays 9 to 11 a.m. Come back with us. Brian Karam from Salon will be up at 5:30 plus your calls, 855-752-4842.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.